first, I want to thank Roberta and Tim for sharing earlier. One of the things that often happens when I'm sitting at a meeting and people from way back are here is like I get this kind of memory of like where I first saw them. And I figured out that I first saw Roberta at the Roop Group when it met on the corner of Roop and Friendship. And I met Tim, and I don't know whether it was Wednesday night or Saturday night in Greensburg, but I can picture seeing you in that building. There's a lot of people here. And my clean date is November 10th of 1987, so I have, I don't know, I think that's 34. I want to try to tell you that like I was 5 when I got clean, but I wasn't. I was just shy of 22, and when I got here just shy of 22, there were not a lot of just shy of 22 people here. The people were old. They were like in their 30s and 40s. And then there were a couple young people who like their parents were dropping them off at the door and picking them up. And so I got here and I was like caught in like the middle of this weird thing, and some of the old people, and now I think about that, you know, those old people, I am now a good, you know, 15, 20 years older than what old was when I got here, would say things to me like, you know, I spilled more than you used, and I'd be thinking, what the fuck are you spilling? Like, I don't spill. You know, and then they'd be talking about the things that they lost. And I'm like, I got here because I couldn't even put anything together to lose. You know, and I say that, and like, there's a part of that that's true, and then there's another part of it. I was a great chameleon and a great make it look good on the outside. So I finished a college degree in 3 years. There's some amphetamines and cocaine that make that happen. But then I forgot to go look for a job, because that's what you're supposed to do when you graduate. And instead of going and looking for a job, there was a bar in the college town that I was in, and I sat at the bar, usually with this particular professor right next to me, and the drug dealer on the other side of me, and I would open up the Uniontown Herald, right, Fayette County. Open it up. If it didn't say English teacher, I closed it and ordered another one. So at some point, kind of at the end of that summer when I didn't have a job, the professor who was sitting next to me said, well, you could always go to grad school, which sounded like a really good idea. They were going to pay me to go to school, which to me equated they were going to pay me to continue to get high. Some things happened, and somewhere in the middle of grad school, I got clean. Through a lot of things that back then I called coincidence or luck or dumb luck. You know, today I believe that that was my higher power working in my life. And so I got here and I chose to stay here. And Tim was talking about that. Like, I have a choice every day when I get up. I get up in the morning and I can choose to do what I've been doing for these past years, or I could choose to pick up. I know that if I choose to pick up, I lose all choice. I'm not willing to lose choice today. I'm not willing to give up that freedom. My home group is the Frick Park 12 and 12 group. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my home group. I was there this morning, Saturday morning, 9 a.m. So let me tell you something about people who get up to be at a home group at 9 a.m. on a Saturday morning. Nobody's sitting there whispering to each other. Nobody came to cop. Most people that end up at our home group end up there because they want recovery. Our format is the last week of the month we now read out of the guiding principles and we read the tradition that goes with the month. So we were on tradition 4 today. The rest of the month we go through the steps. People are not at a step in tradition meeting at 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning because they're not serious about their recovery. We said, you know, we have a home group member who always says it's a meat and potatoes meeting. We don't have any gravy, we don't have any cake. It is the nuts and bolts of what Narcotics Anonymous is. And the truth is, since 1989, every home group I've had has been literature-based. So today we were on tradition 4, autonomy, talking about group autonomy, and that, like, each group picks its format, and that format appeals to different kinds of people, or it appeals to a different person at a different place in their recovery. And I think it's really important that we have such a variety of types of meetings that we have around here. I've been to other places where literally every meeting is a speaker meeting. I don't know about you, I have the attention of a fly. When I got here, I had the attention of a fly. Somewhere in the middle there, I think I had a little bit more attention, like the attention of a toddler. And as I age, my attention, I struggle. So speaker meetings never really spoke to me. It wasn't like where I got filled up. For me, like, Narcotics Anonymous, there's like two ways I look at Narcotics Anonymous. There's the program, which is the steps and the traditions, and there's the fellowship, which are you guys. The steps and the traditions have never failed me. And so if I go to a meeting, for me, that's based on the steps and the traditions, people tend to stay focused in what they're sharing. They tend to talk about something about either how what they read in the reading spoke to them or what their experience was with that step in tradition. And like that really carries the message to me today. And it has for a long time. I think it's really important that, you know, I look at the options that I have available to me and like figure out what I need on any given day. You know, there are days that like I need to share something, whether it's something good or something bad, I need to share. And so like on those days, I'm gonna end up at a discussion meeting. There are some days where like I just need to be around you people. I just really need the fellowship. I don't really care what anybody has to say. I don't care about steps, and I don't care about them damn traditions, and I don't care about anything other than I need the hug that I get. I need to look somebody in the eye and just feel connected spiritually. And so like sometimes when that's what I need, I show up at that speaker meeting because I'll daze out because I'm really there for before and after the meeting, and what happened in the middle isn't really what I was there for. And that's okay today. Like, I get to come here and figure out what I need and who can give it to me and how I can do what I need to do to stay clean another day, to not kill my husband, my kids, my coworkers, whatever it is. And Roberta was talking about that when she was sharing that idea that like the disease still lives in my head and it comes out in all sorts of other ways. And this is the solution that I know of to get through that. I want to tell you guys a little bit about my morning this morning and then see where that takes me. I got up this morning like every other morning. I get up somewhere between 6 and 6:30. I have a spiritual practice that in the winter includes going up into my meditation room and turning the heater on. before I go up to do my practice and in the summer is turning the fan on. And like today was the perfect day because I got up there and it was 66 degrees and I didn't have to turn anything on. So like I didn't even have to go back downstairs and pause. So my morning practice looks something like this. I do anywhere between 10 minutes and an hour of yoga, and then anywhere between 1 minute and 30 minutes of meditation. And then I journal. So this morning I get up, I turn the computer on because I use a computer app that I use for my yoga. And on my desktop is a picture that I made years ago of my dad. And it's two pictures of him together. And one is him at about 22 in his army uniform. And the other is from about 10 years ago. And he's all dapper in a tuxedo. I don't know what event they were going to, but I had put these together. And I just looked at that and smiled and felt really connected to my dad. And then I switch over and I do my yoga practice and I go to open my app on my phone for my that I use to time my meditation, and I looked at the date. Today's 2 years since my dad passed. And like, it's really weird because when I got asked to speak and it was April 30th, like I knew it was April 30th and I knew that was the day my dad passed and all of that, but like, somehow this morning, like that, I don't know, like brain fart, I don't know what to call it, but like it just, I woke up this morning kind of unaware, but clearly on a subconscious spiritual level, very aware. So I want to tell you a little bit about my journey in recovery and I want to kind of try to honor my father in that today. And so some things like about my relationship with my father. I don't know about anybody else in here, but to say that my relationship with my father was tumultuous is probably being nice about it. And I'd like to say that like, well, I'll say this. I blamed it all on him. Does that surprise anybody? I blamed it all on him. And so now when I think back to things about my dad, my parents got divorced when I was 7. And he moved out of our house and moved in at my grandmother's. And the day that he moved out, I was at my friend's house playing, and he came over to say goodbye to me. And when he said goodbye to me, he said, you know, whatever he said, goodbye, blah, blah, blah. But he said to me, if your toast gets stuck in the toaster, make sure you unplug it before you put a fork in it. And I just remember being a kid and going, uh-huh. Now, I was 7 years old. That was almost 50 years ago. Why do I remember exactly what he said? I don't know. But when I think about that today, what I know is that was my father saying, I love you. My father, my relationship with my father often felt very transactional. And the words I love you never came out of his mouth without him handing me cash, whether I was 10 or 40. And I hated that. You know, when I think back to being a young kid, I don't remember feeling love. And that's not to say that he didn't love me. I mean, I 100% know that he did. But the way he said it wasn't a way that I heard it. And I know that that impacted me. I left home. So let me say this. So I started using in the summer of 1976, I was 10 years old. By the time I was 12, I have a diary entry from just before my 12th birthday that talks about what I did that day, and then skipped a couple sentences and said, I'm not gonna get high anymore. And then it skipped another line and said, I don't think. So at 12 years old, I was already caught up in the grips. At the time, I was living in California with my mother, who was actively in her addiction. And that really wasn't very pretty. So at some point in October of that year that I was 12, I ran away from home with my mom. Now picture this, we lived in a second floor apartment. This is October in Southern California. She punished me for something, and so I was in my room. I opened up my window, pushed out the screen, climbed out, hung from the edge of the window, let go, wearing a tube top, short shorts, and no shoes. That's not a bright way to run away from home. And I don't know what that did to her, I mean, honestly. But I ended up walking about 5 miles like that to, there was this young couple that lived in our apartment complex, and then they had moved away. And when I say young couple, like she was 19 and he was 23, and all of us young kids would go to their house and get high, their apartment. And so they'd moved and got a house, and I walked over to their house, which was like 5 miles away. And I called my mom, because that's what the girl told me I should do. And I called my mom and I said, hi mom, it's me. And she said, me who? And I said, Cheryl, your daughter. She said, I don't have a daughter, and hung up the phone. So this woman, girl, young person, whatever you call a 19-year-old who's married in 1978, says, well, we need to call your dad. And I call my dad, and you know, I don't know, we tell him what happened, whatever, whatever. I stay at these people's house, get high. The next day, my dad had called a friend of his that lived in Southern California, and the next thing I knew, you know, this guy who I'd met once when I was five had bought me a plane ticket and clothes to wear, and sent me back to New York to live with my dad. That's love. Like, he didn't have custody of me. I was way far away. He did what he could do to remedy the situation. You know, I got there. I he registers me for school. I have like this perfect opportunity to probably just start all over again and be somebody new, except I'm caught up in the grips. So I immediately find the right people, the right places, and the right things for what I want to do. Fast forward a few years later, I'm done, because the difference between my mom and my dad was my mom was very permissive, and my dad was very authoritarian, and getting high at his house was getting hard. He had chased me down at the park. I don't even remember all the details of it, but I had gotten some guy to get me liquor, and my dad somehow found out about it, and he comes and finds me at the park, and I am running through the park with my liquor in my bag, in my purse, and my dad is chasing me, and you know, he gets some jogger to stop me and gets me home, and he calls the cops. and, you know, tries the scared straight routine, which, you know. I know today, looking back, that everything he did for me out of love. And so at some point I decided, without like just coming, I don't know about, I was not a good communicator. And I was a manipulator, and I also wanted to not take responsibility for my own stuff. So I had this grand scheme of how I was going to get him to let me go back to live with my mom. And he found out about my grand scheme, probably by reading my diary, but, you know. And he just sat me down and he said, if you want to go, finish the school year, and I'll put you on the plane, and you'll go. And when I think back to that, I can only imagine like what he was really feeling inside. But he also knew it was 1980, and in 1980, dads did not get custody of their children. He also knew that if I didn't want to be there, I was not going to make it easy. And that it was just going to be damaging and harmful. And he let me go. And I still remember, like, he called every Wednesday and every Sunday night when I didn't live with him. And that was love. And then my mother died, and I ended up back living with him. And I'm going to like kind of fast forward through some stuff. But I moved out of my dad's house when I was 18 years old. And I moved out with this big fight in the middle of the parking lot in their condominium complex. And I honestly don't know what we were fighting about. But I remember the words that I said, and I remember that I picked them very carefully because I knew he would have to look them up in the dictionary. And I left. Let me take this back. So I left, and the next day I went back, and I broke in. Well, I didn't break in because I still had a key. But I went upstairs into their room and I broke into a locked box to take out some belongings of mine, raided the medicine cabinet and my stepmother's jewelry box. The next day they put a security system on the house. That was the last day that I lived at home with my parents. To do that to the people that love you the most. And I got clean. That would have been in 1984. So I got clean in 1987. And my first trip home after I got clean, I don't know, I had about a year clean. They let me stay in the house. If I went upstairs, they followed me. If I went downstairs to the basement, they followed me. And the whole time I was there, I was on edge. I literally sat at the kitchen table, and they had these chairs, and I was holding the chairs because it was so difficult for me to figure out how to be in any kind of healthy interaction. I had all this resentment and all of this anger and all of this stuff that I didn't know what to do with and didn't know how to express. And I actually had drawn blood by squeezing so hard that my fingernails went into the palm of my hands. And so I said, oh, I gotta go. I probably said I had to go get cigarettes. And I got to a payphone and I called my sponsor. I talked to my sponsor for a while, and I called somebody else, and I talked to some people, and I made it like through that weekend trip. But I didn't go back home again until 1990. Because I could not be present and be clean and handle the feelings that came with that. And by that time, some of the feelings were no longer that resentment and anger towards them, but that self-hatred and all of that that came with recognizing my role in everything that happened in that relationship. So, you know, I stayed clean. I got married and divorced here, and I got married again. So let me say this. I want to say this because I think this is really important. We get into a lot of relationships here. I got into a lot of relationships here. And when I got clean and in the early years of my recovery, the fellowship was much smaller. And like, I didn't have the ability to say, oh, I'm not going to that meeting anymore because that guy I slept with goes there. Because that would have meant for me that I couldn't have gone to a meeting. I'm just being truthful. When my now husband, who's now been my husband for 26 years, went to my old home group with me for the first time, when we left, he looked at me and said, is there anybody in that room you didn't sleep with? And I was like, a couple? You know, so I mean, I'm just being honest. Like, I got clean, I didn't get well. I got clean and I got feelings and I didn't know how to make them go away, but you knew how to make them go away for me. And I chose to find my recovery in Narcotics Anonymous, so I couldn't let whatever happened between the sheets keep me from the meeting. And so I kept coming to meetings, and I finally got to a place where it was like, I need to fix some things at home. I need to try to build relationships with my parents. And I went back home. So 1990, I have 3 years clean. I get in the house. I go to carry my bags upstairs, and my stepmother's walking up behind me. I've got 3 years clean. They're still following me up the stairs. I had 7 years clean. I watched all sorts of people that I got clean with get their mom's purses and the car keys and the keys to the house at 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, a year. 7 years clean. I walked upstairs to put the bags away and came back down, and my husband, who had sat down and was talking to them, and then I don't even remember, they got up. He like leans over to me and says, no one followed you up. I hadn't even noticed, because that was no longer what was so important to me. Like, they could have followed me up till I had 100 years clean. Like, I was having a healthy relationship. That's what was important to me. I still had this thing. My dad was still, you know, handing me cash when he said, I love you. And I remember one trip we were leaving, and he hands me a check, and I don't even look at the check. He says, I love you. He hands me the check, and I try to hand it back. I said, I don't want it. You just told me you love me. That's enough. He's like, here, take it. So this was not a good thing, but I did it. I tore it up. Like, threw it. Like, it wasn't, you know. He sent a check in the mail, and I was like, okay, I'm going to cash it. So, but I remember, you know, I had been adamant and adamant and adamant about, I just want him to say I love you without sending me any cash. And I don't remember what birthday it was, but I had a birthday. And we were a little financially strapped as it was coming up on my birthday. And I'm thinking in the back of my head, I'm thinking, it's my birthday. I'm going to get a check. I still have the card. It was like the most beautiful, you're my daughter and I'm proud of you and I love the woman you've become and all of this and, you know, all of that. All my love, Dad. No check. What Narcotics Anonymous has given me is the ability to be present for the people that matter. So, I feel like my dad was sick for a very long time. And every trip I went down to see him in Florida, I knew this could be the last time. Like every trip. And he had, you know, it was those kind of things where it's like all of these health conditions, but nothing is like this diagnosis and, you know. So every trip I'd leave preparing that, like, I said I love you and I said my goodbyes and all of that, and then there would be another trip. And so the last trip that I went on, went down there pre-COVID, he was bad. It was really bad. And I got home and I called my brothers and I said, we have to come up with a plan. You know, my stepmom was down there and I said, she can't do this by herself. So we need to come up with a plan because this is going to be soon. And first of all, the fact that my brothers even thought that what I had to say mattered was like a big thing. And we came up with a plan and we planned on, I had just come back, gonna wait a week or two and my other brother was gonna go down and so we had this whole thing planned out. And so my brother was, then COVID hit, my brother was down there and I was supposed to be coming down next and I had a flight booked for May 2nd. And my brother's down there and he says, you're gonna have to come down before then. And so I booked and canceled 5 flights because he died on the 30th and they said, you have to be here tomorrow. I was down there, we buried my dad, and then all of a sudden, both of my brothers had gone home, and it was just me and my stepmother, and this is the woman who I used to say, call the bitch who married my father. And we were down there, and I was like, it's about to be Mother's Day. I can't leave her by herself without my dad on Mother's Day. So I ended up staying down there 14 days, and my brothers called me the martyr. What my dad would have wanted, and the way I can continue to make amends for breaking into her jewelry, stealing her medicine, ruining her birthday when I ran away from home and ended up back with my dad. Just all of these things. The way I make amends today is that I live in love with her. I live in harmony with her. I went down 3 times to help her pack up the house. I went down again to help her move in to her apartment. I am able to be present in the lives of the people who were present for me when I was saying F you. That's what Narcotics Anonymous has given me. I got a call today from my mom, and my one brother and his wife are down with her from New Jersey, and my other brother lives down in Florida now, and so they called me from the cemetery just so that we could all be present together for a moment at the cemetery. And I was able to do that with them, and I got off the phone, and like, the cemetery's not my thing. Like, my dad's not at the cemetery. My dad was with me this morning when I opened the picture of him, when I sat in my meditation and I heard his voice. And I heard him say, I love you. And I heard him say, I'm proud of you. And I heard him say, thank you for everything you do for the family. And that is all because I learned how to do that here. I've taken the things that I've learned here, the way I've been able to be here for people, the way they were here for me and are here for me when I need it. And I've been able to practice that everywhere else in my life. And I am so grateful for the life that Narcotics Anonymous has given me. Thanks for letting me share.